The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
My lover is experiencing reverse evolution. I tell no one. I don't know how it happened, only that one day he was my lover, and the next he was some kind of ape.
You're listening to Marion Seldes reading from Amy Bender's story, The Rememberer. You'll be hearing the story later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. What unites this program's two rather different stories, the first quite serious, and the second very comically imaginative, if in fact equally serious underneath all the humor? Well, as you'll hear, both of these short fictions are tales of deepening insight, stories whose main characters undergo profound and life-changing experiences, and finally, if slowly, reach a new level of understanding of what it has all meant. We begin with The Seventh Man by the wonderful Japanese writer Haruki Murakami, who was born in Kyoto in 1949. Many Murakami stories we have read on Selected Shorts have a very hip, modern feel to them. This one, The Seventh Man, in its opening paragraphs, feels a little like a Kurosawa period piece, as many men sit around a circle on a stormy night and tell their stories. Here's the story that the seventh man in the circle tells, as read for us by our regular reader, John Shea.
Thank you. Thank you, Isaiah. A huge wave nearly swept me away, said the seventh man, almost whispering. It happened one September afternoon when I was 10 years old. The man was the last one to tell his story that night. The hands of the clock had moved past 10. The small group that huddled in a circle could hear the wind tearing through the darkness outside, heading west. It shook the trees and set the windows to rattling and moved past the house with one final whistle. It was the biggest wave I'd ever seen in my life, he said. A strange wave. A giant wave. He paused. It just barely missed me. But in my place, it swallowed everything that mattered most to me and swept it off to another world. I took years to find it again and to recover from the experience, precious years that can never be replaced. The seventh man seemed to be in his mid-50s. He was a thin man, tall, with a mustache. And next to his right eye, he had a short but deep-looking scar that could have been made by the stab of a small blade. Stiff, bristly patches of white marked his short hair. His face had the look you see on people when they can't quite find the words they need. In his case, though, the expression seemed to have been there from long before, as though it were part of him. The man wore a simple blue shirt under a gray tweed coat, and every now and then he would bring his hand to his collar. None of those assembled there knew his name or what he did for a living. He cleared his throat, and for a moment or two his words were lost in silence. The others waited for him to go on. In my case, it was a wave, he said. There's no way for me to tell, of course, what it will be for each of you. But in my case, it just happened to take the form of a gigantic wave, It presented itself to me all of a sudden one day, without warning, in the shape of a gigantic wave. And it was devastating. I grew up in the seaside town in S Prefecture. It was such a small town, I doubt that any of you would recognize the name if I were to mention it. My father was the local doctor, and so I had a rather comfortable childhood. And ever since I could remember, my best friend was a boy I'll call K. His house was close to ours, and he was a grade behind me in school. We were like brothers, walking to and from school together and always playing together when we got home. We never once fought during our long friendship. I did have a brother, 6 years older, but what with the age difference and the difference in our personalities, we were never very close. My real brotherly affection went to my friend, Kay. Kay was a frail, skinny little thing with a pale complexion and a face almost pretty enough to be a girl's. He had some kind of speech impediment, though, which might have made him seem retarded to anyone who didn't know him. And because he was so frail, I always played his protector, whether at school or at home. I was kind of big and athletic, and the other kids all looked up to me. But the main reason I enjoyed spending time with Kay was that he was such a sweet, pure-hearted boy. He was not the least bit retarded, but because of his impediment, he didn't do well in school. In most subjects, he could barely keep up. But in art class, he was great. You just give him a pencil or paints, and he would make pictures that were so full of life that even the teacher was amazed. He won prizes in one contest after another, and I'm sure that he would have become a famous painter if he had continued his art into childhood, into adulthood. And he liked to do seascapes. He'd go out to the shore for hours painting, and I would often sit beside him, watching the swift, precise movements of his brush, and wondering how, in a few seconds, he could possibly create such lively shapes and colors, where until then there had only been blank white paper. And I realize now it was a matter of pure talent. One year, in September, a huge typhoon hit our area. The area said it was going to be the worst in 10 years. The schools were closed and all the shops in town lowered their shutters in preparation for the storm. And starting early in the morning, my father and brother went around the house nailing shut all the storm doors while my mother spent the day in the kitchen cooking emergency provisions. We filled bottles and canteens with water and packed our most important possessions in rucksacks for possible evacuation. To the adults, typhoons were an annoyance and a threat that they had to face almost annually, but to the kids, removed as we were from such practical concerns, it was just a great big circus. It was a wonderful source of excitement. And just after noon, the color of the sky began to change all of a sudden. There was something strange and unreal about it. And I stayed out on the porch watching the sky until the wind began to howl and the rain began to beat against the house with a weird dry sound like handfuls of sand. And then we closed the last storm door and we gathered together in one room of the darkened house. We listened to the radio. This particular storm did not have a great deal of rain, it said, but the winds were doing a lot of damage, blowing roofs off of houses and capsizing ships. Many people had been killed or injured by flying debris, and over again they warned people against leaving their homes. Every once in a while, the house would creak and shudder as if a huge hand were shaking it, and sometimes there'd be a great crash of some heavy-sounding object against the storm door. My father guessed that these were the tiles blowing off the neighbors' houses. For lunch, we ate the rice and omelets my mother had cooked, listening to the radio, waiting for the typhoon to blow past. But the typhoon gave no sign of blowing past. The radio said that it had lost momentum almost as soon as it came ashore at S Prefecture, and now it was moving northeast at the pace of a slow runner. The wind kept up its savage howling as it tried to uproot everything that stood on land and carry it to the far ends of the earth. Perhaps an hour had gone by with the wind at its worst like this, when a hush fell over everything. All of a sudden, it was so quiet, we could hear a bird crying in the distance. My father opened the storm door, a crack, and he looked outside. The wind had stopped, and the rain had ceased to fall. Thick gray clouds edged across the sky, and patches of blue showed up here and there. The trees in the yard were still dripping their heavy burden of rainwater. "We're in the eye of the storm," my father told me. "It'll stay quiet like this for a while, maybe 15-20 minutes, like a kind of intermission, and then the wind will come back the way it was before." Well, I asked him if I could go outside. He said I could walk around a little if I didn't go far. "But I want you to come right back here at the first sign of wind." I went out. I started to explore. It was hard to believe that a wild storm had been blowing there until a few minutes before. I looked up at the sky, and I felt the storm's great eye up there, fixing its cold stare on all of us below. Well, no such eye existed, of course. We were just in that momentary quiet spot at the center of the pool of whirling air. And while the grown-ups checked for damage to the house, I went down to the beach. The road was littered with broken tree branches, some of them thick pine boughs that would have been too heavy for an adult to lift alone. There were shattered roof tiles everywhere, and cars with cracked windshields, and even a doghouse that had tumbled into the middle of the street. A big hand might have swung down from the sky and flattened everything in its path. Kay saw me walking down the road and came outside. "Where are you going?" he asked. "I'm just going down to look at the beach," I said. Without a word, he came along with me, and he had a little white dog, and that dog followed after us. "But the minute we get any wind, though, we're going straight back home," I said. And Kay gave me a silent nod. The shore was a 200-yard walk from my house. It was lined with a concrete breakwater, a big dike that stood as high as I was tall in those days. We had to climb a short stairway to reach the water's edge. That was where we came to play almost every day, so there was no part of it that we didn't know well. In the eye of the typhoon, though, it all looked different. The color of the sky and the sea, the sound of the waves, the smell of the tide, and the whole expanse of the shore. We sat atop the breakwater for a while, taking in the view without a word to each other. We were supposedly in the middle of a great typhoon, and yet the waves were strangely hushed. And the point where they washed against the beach was much farther away than usual, even at low tide. The white sand stretched out before us as far as we could see. The whole huge space felt like a room without furniture, except for the band of flotsam that lined the beach. We stepped down to the other side of the breakwater and walked along the broad beach, examining the things that had come to rest there, plastic toys, sandals, chunks of wood that had probably once been parts of furniture, pieces of clothing, unusual bottles, broken crates with foreign writing on them, and other less recognizable items. It was like a big candy store. The storm must have carried these things from very far away. Whenever something unusual caught our attention, we would pick it up and look at it every which way. And when we were done, Kay's dog would come over and give it a good sniff. We couldn't have been doing this for more than 5 minutes when I realized that the waves had come right up next to me. Without any sound or other warning, the sea had suddenly stretched its long, smooth tongue out to where I stood on the beach. I'd never seen anything like it before. Child, though I was, I had grown up on the shore and knew how frightening the ocean could be, the savagery with which it could strike, unannounced. And so I had taken care to keep well back from the waterline. In spite of that, the waves had slid up to within inches of where I stood, And then, just as soundlessly, the water drew back and stayed back. The waves that had approached me were as unthreatening as waves can be, a gentle washing of the sandy beach. But something ominous about them, something like the touch of a reptile's skin, had sent a chill down my spine. My fear was totally groundless and totally real. I knew instinctively that they were alive. The waves were alive. They knew I was here, and they were planning to grab me. I felt as if some huge man-eating beast were lying somewhere on a grassy plain, dreaming of the moment it would pounce and tear me to pieces with its sharp teeth. I had to run away. "I'm getting out of here!" I yelled to Kay. He was maybe 10 yards down the beach, squatting with his back to me and looking at something. I was sure that I had yelled loud enough, but my voice did not seem to have reached him. He might have been so absorbed in whatever it was that he had found that my call made no impression on him. Kay was like that. He would get involved with things to the point of forgetting everything else, or possibly I had not yelled as loudly as I thought. I do recall that my voice sounded strange to me, as though it belonged to someone else. And then I heard a deep rumbling sound. It seemed to shake the earth. No. Actually, before I heard the rumble, I heard another sound, a weird gurgling, as though a lot of water was surging up through a hole in the ground. It continued for a while and then stopped, after which I heard the strange rumbling. Even that was not enough to make Kay look up. He was still squatting, looking down at something at his feet in deep concentration. He probably did not hear the rumbling. How he could have missed such an earth-shaking sound, I don't know. This may seem odd, but it might have been a sound that only I could hear. Some special kind of sound. Not even Kay's dog seemed to notice it, and you know how sensitive dogs are to sound. So I told myself to run over to Kay, to grab hold of him, to get out of there. Oh, that was the only thing to do. I knew that the wave was coming, and Kay didn't know. And as clearly as I knew what I ought to be doing, I found myself running the other way, running at full speed toward the dike alone. What made me do this, I'm sure, was fear. A fear so overpowering that it took my voice away and set my legs to running on their own. And I ran, stumbling across the soft sand beach to the breakwater, where I turned and I shouted to Kay, "Hurry, Kay, get out of there! The wave is coming!" And this time my voice worked fine. And the rumbling had stopped, I realized, and now was finally Kay heard my shouting and he looked up. But it was too late. A wave, like a huge snake with its head held high, poised to strike, was racing toward the shore. I had never seen anything like it in my life. It had to be as tall as a 3-story building. Soundlessly, in my memory at least, the image is soundless, it rose up behind Kay to block out the sky. Kay looked at me for a few seconds, uncomprehending, and then, as if sensing something, he turned toward the wave. He tried to run, but now there was no time to run. And in the next instant, the wave had swallowed him. It hit him full on, like a locomotive at full speed. The wave crashed onto the beach, shattering into a million leaping waves that flew into the air and plunged over the dike where I stood. I was able to dodge its impact by ducking behind the breakwater. The spray wet my clothes, nothing more. I scrambled back up onto the wall and scanned the shore. By then, the wave had turned and, with a wild cry, was rushing back out to sea. It looked like part of a gigantic rug that had been yanked by someone at the other end of the earth. Nowhere on the shore could I find any trace of Kay or his dog. There was only the empty beach. The receding wave had now pulled out so much water from the shore that it seemed to expose the entire ocean bottom. And I stood alone on the breakwater. I was frozen in place. And the silence came over everything again. A desperate silence, as though sound itself had been ripped from the earth. The wave had swallowed Kay and had disappeared into the far distance. And I stood there, wondering what to do. Should I go down to the beach? I mean, Kay might be down there somewhere, buried in the sand, but I decided not to leave the dike. I knew from experience that big waves often come in twos and threes. And I'm not sure how much time went by, maybe 10 or 20 seconds of eerie emptiness. When, just as I had guessed, the next wave came. Another gigantic roar shook the beach, and again the sound faded, and another huge wave raised itself to strike. And it towered before me, blocking out the sky like a deadly cliff. But this time, though, I didn't run. I stood rooted to the seawall, entranced, waiting for it to attack. What good would it be to run, I thought, now that Kay had been taken? Or perhaps I simply froze, overcome with fear. I can't be sure what it was that kept me standing there. And the second wave was just as big as the first, maybe even bigger. From far above my head, it began to fall, lose its shape like a brick wall, slowly crumbling. It was so huge that it no longer looked like a real wave. It seemed to be some other thing, something from another far-off world that just happened to assume the shape of a wave. And I readied myself from the moment that the darkness would take me. I didn't even close my eyes. I remember hearing my heart pound with incredible clarity. The moment the wave came before me, however, it stopped. All at once, it seemed to run out of energy, to lose its forward motion and simply hover there in space, crumbling in stillness. And in its crest, inside its cruel, transparent tongue, what I saw was Kay. Now, some of you may find this impossible to believe, and if so, okay, I don't blame you. I myself have trouble accepting it even now, and I can't explain what I saw any better than you can, but I know it was no illusion, it was no hallucination. I am telling you, as honestly as I can, what happened at that moment, what really happened. In the tip of the wave, as if enclosed in some kind of transparent capsule, floated Kay's body, reclining on its side. But that is not all. Kay was looking straight at me, smiling. Right there in front of me, close enough so that I could have reached out and touched him, was my friend Kay, who only moments before had been swallowed by the wave, and he was smiling at me. Not with an ordinary smile, it was big. It was a big, wide-open grin that literally stretched from ear to ear. His cold, frozen eyes were locked on mine. He was no longer the Kay I knew, and his right arm was stretched out in my direction as if he were trying to grab my hand and pull me into the other world where he was now. A little closer and his hand would have caught mine, but having missed, Kay smiled at me one more time, his grin wider than ever. And I seemed to have lost consciousness at that point. The next thing I knew, I was in bed in my father's clinic. And as soon as I awoke, the nurse went to call my father, who came running. He took my pulse, he studied my pupils, he put his hand on my forehead. And I tried to move my arm, but I couldn't lift it. I was burning with fever, and my mind was clouded. I had been wrestling with a high fever for some time, apparently. "You've been asleep for 3 days," my father said to me. A neighbor who had seen the whole thing had picked me up and carried me home. They had not been able to find Kay. I wanted to say something to my father. I had to say something to him, but my numb and swollen tongue could not form words. I felt as if some kind of creature had taken up residence in my mouth. My father asked me to tell him my name, but But before I could remember what it was, I lost consciousness again, sinking into darkness. And altogether, I stayed in bed for a week on a liquid diet. I vomited several times, had bouts of delirium. My father told me afterward that it was so bad that he had been afraid that I might suffer permanent neurological damage from the shock and high fever. One way or another, though, I managed to recover. Physically, at least. But my life would never be the same again. They never found Kay's body. They never found his dog, either. Usually, when someone drowned in that area, the body would wash up a few days later on the shore in a small inlet to the east. Kay's body never did. The big waves probably carried it far out to sea, too far for it to reach the shore. It must have sunk to the ocean bottom and been eaten by fish. The search went on for a very long time, thanks to the cooperation of the local fishermen, but eventually it petered out. Without a body, there was never a funeral. Half-crazed, Kay's parents would wander up and down the beach every day, or they would shut themselves up at home, chanting sutras. As great a blow as this had been for them, though, Kay's parents never chided me for having taken their son down to the shore in the midst of a typhoon. They knew how I had always loved and protected Kay as if he had been my own little brother. My parents, too, made a point of never mentioning the incident in my presence. But I knew the truth. I knew that I could have saved Kay if I had tried. I probably could have run over and dragged him out of the reach of the wave. It would have been close, but as I went over the timing of the events in memory, it always seemed to me that I could have made it. And as I said before, overcome with fear, I abandoned him there and saved only myself. And it pained me all the more that Kay's parents failed to blame me and that everyone else was so careful never to say anything about what had happened. And it took me a long time to recover from the emotional shock. I stayed out of school for weeks. I hardly ate a thing. I spent each day in bed, staring at the ceiling. And Kay was always there, lying in the wave tip, grinning at me, his hand outstretched, beckoning. I couldn't get that searing image out of my mind. And when I managed to sleep, it was there in my dreams, except that in my dreams, Kay would hop out of his capsule and grab my wrist and drag me back inside with him. And then there was another dream I had. I'm swimming in the ocean, and it's a beautiful summer afternoon, and I'm doing an easy breaststroke far from shore. The sun is beating down on my back, and the water feels good. And then, all of a sudden, someone grabs my right leg. I feel an ice-cold grip on my ankle. It's strong, too strong to shake off. I'm being dragged down under the surface. I see Kay's face there. He has the same huge grin split from ear to ear, his eyes locked on mine. I try to scream, but my voice will not come. I swallow water, and my lungs begin to fill. I wake up in the darkness, screaming, breathless, drenched in sweat. And at the end of the year, I plead with my parents to let me move to another town. I couldn't go on living in sight of the beach where Kay had been swept away, and my nightmares wouldn't stop. If I didn't get out of there, I'd go crazy. My parents understood and made arrangements for me to live elsewhere. I moved to Nagano Prefecture in January to live with my father's family in a mountain village near Komoro. I finished elementary school in Nagano and stayed on through junior and senior high school there. I never went home, even for holidays. My parents came to visit me now and then. I live in Nagano to this day. I graduated from College of Engineering in the city of Nagano, and I went to work for a precision toolmaker in the area, and I still work for them. I live like anybody else. As you can see, there's nothing unusual about me. I'm not very sociable, but I have a few friends I go mountain climbing with. Once in a while, when I got away from my hometown, I stopped having nightmares all the time. They remain part of my life, though. They would come to me now and then like bill collectors at the door. It happened whenever I was on the verge of forgetting. It was always the same dream, down to the smallest detail. I would wake up screaming, my sheets soaked with sweat. And this is probably why I never married. I didn't want to wake someone sleeping next to me with my screams in the middle of the night. I've been in love with several women over the years, but I've never spent a night with any of them. The terror was in my bones. It was something I could never share with another person. I stayed away from my hometown for 40 years. I never went near that seashore or any other. I was afraid that if I did, my dream might happen in reality. I had always enjoyed swimming, but after that I never even went to a pool. I wouldn't go near deep rivers or lakes. I avoided boats. Wouldn't take a plane to go abroad. Despite all these precautions, I couldn't get rid of the image of myself drowning. Like Kay's cold hand, this dark premonition caught hold of my mind and refused to let go. And then last spring, I finally revisited the beach where Kay had been taken by the wave. My father had died of cancer the year before, and my brother had sold the old house. In going through the storage shed, he had found a cardboard carton crammed with childhood things of mine, which he sent to me in Nagano. Most of it was useless junk, but there was one bundle of pictures that Kay had painted and given to me. My parents had probably put them away for me as a keepsake of Kay, but the pictures did nothing but reawaken the old terror. They made me feel as if Kay's spirit would spring back to life from them, so I quickly returned them to their paper wrapping, intending to throw them away. But I couldn't make myself do it, though. And after several days of indecision, I opened the bundle again, and I forced myself to take a long, hard look at Kay's watercolors. Most of them were landscapes, pictures of the familiar stretch of ocean and sand beach and pine woods and the town, all done with that special clarity and coloration I knew so well from Kay's hand. They were still amazingly vivid despite the years and had been executed with even greater skill than I recalled. And as I leafed through the bundle, I found myself steeped in warm memories. The deep feelings of the boy Kay were there in his pictures, the way his eyes were opened on the world. The things we did together, the places we went together, began to come back to me with a great intensity. And I realized that his eyes were my eyes, that I myself had looked upon the world back then with the same lively, unclouded vision as the boy who had walked by my side. And I made a habit after that of studying one of Kay's pictures at my desk each day when I got home from work. I could sit there for hours with one painting. In each, I found another of those soft landscapes of childhood that I had shut out of my memory for so long. I had a sense whenever I looked at one of Kay's works that something was permeating my very flesh. Perhaps a week had gone by like this when the thought suddenly struck me one evening I might have been making a terrible mistake all those years. As he lay there in the tip of the way, surely Kay had not been looking at me with hatred or resentment. He had not been trying to take me away with him. And that terrible grin he had fixed me with, that too could have been an accident of angle or light or shadow, not a conscious act on Kay's part. He had probably already lost consciousness, or perhaps he had been giving me a gentle smile of eternal parting. The intense look of hatred I thought I saw on his face had been nothing but a reflection of the profound terror that had taken control of me for the moment. And the more I studied Kay's watercolor that evening, the greater the conviction with which I began to believe these new thoughts of mine. For no matter how long I continued to look at the picture, I could find nothing in it but a boy's gentle, innocent spirit. And I went on sitting at my desk for a very long time. There was nothing else I could do. The sun went down. The pale darkness of the evening began to envelop the room. And then came the deep silence of the night, which seemed to go on forever. At last, the scales tipped and dark gave way to dawn. The new day's sun tinged the sky with pink, and the birds awoke to sing. And it was then that I knew I must go back. I threw a few things in the bag, and I called the company to say I would not be in, and I boarded a train for my old hometown. I did not find the same quiet little seaside town that I remembered. An industrial city had sprung up nearby during the rapid development of the 60s, bringing great changes to the landscape. The one little gift shop by the station had grown into a mall. The town's only movie theater had been turned into a supermarket. My house was no longer there. It had been demolished some months before, leaving only a scrape on the earth. The trees in the yard had all been cut down, and patches of weeds dotted the black stretch of ground. Kay's old house had disappeared as well, having been replaced by a concrete parking lot full of commuter cars and vans. Not that I was overcome by sentiment, the town had ceased to be mine long before. I walked down to the shore and climbed the steps of the breakwater. On the other side, as always, the ocean stretched off into the distance, unobstructed, huge, the horizon a single straight line. The shoreline, too, looked the same as it had before. The long beach, the lapping waves, people strolling at the water's edge. The time was after 4 o'clock, and the soft sun of the late afternoon embraced everything below as it began its long, almost meditative descent to the west. I lowered my bag to the sand and sat down next to it in silent appreciation of the gentle seascape. Looking at this scene, it was impossible to imagine that a great typhoon had once raged here, that a massive wave had swallowed my best friend and all the world. There was almost no one left now, surely, who remembered those terrible events. It began to seem as if the whole thing were an illusion that I had dreamed up in vivid detail. And then I realized that the deep darkness inside me had vanished. Suddenly as it had come. I raised myself from the sand, and without bothering either to take off my shoes or roll up my cuffs, I walked into the surf to let the waves lap at my ankles. Almost in reconciliation, it seemed, the same waves that had washed up on the beach when I was a boy were now fondly washing my feet, soaking my black shoes and pant cuffs. There would be one long, slow-moving wave, and then a pause, and then another wave would come and go, and the people passing by gave me odd looks, but I didn't care. I had found my way back again at last. And I looked up at the sky. A few gray cotton chunks of cloud hung there motionless, and they seemed to hang there just for me, though I'm not sure why I felt that way. And then I remembered having looked up at the sky like this in search of the eye of the typhoon. And then, inside me, the axis of time gave one great heave. 40 long years collapsed like a dilapidated house, mixing old time and new time together in a single swirling mass. All sounds faded, and the light around me shuddered. I lost my balance, and I fell into the waves. My heart throbbed at the back of my throat, and my arms and legs lost all sensation. And I lay that way for a long time, face in the water, unable to stand. But I was not afraid. No, not at all. There was no longer anything for me to fear. Those days were gone. And I stopped having terrible nightmares. And I no longer wake up screaming in the middle of the night. And I am now trying to start life over again. No, I know it's probably too late to start again. I may not have that much time left to live. But even if it comes too late, I am grateful that in the end I was able to attain a kind of salvation, to effect some sort of recovery. Yes, grateful. I could have come to the end of my life unsaved, still screaming in the dark, afraid. And the seventh man fell quiet and turned his gaze upon each of the others. And no one spoke or moved or even seemed to breathe. All were waiting for the rest of his story. And outside, the wind had fallen and nothing stirred. And the seventh man brought his hand to his collar once again in search of words. They tell us that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But I don't believe that, he said. And then a moment later he added, oh, there is fear, all right. The fear is there. It comes to us in many forms at different times and overwhelms us. But the most frightening thing we can do at such times is to turn our backs on it, to close our eyes. For then we take the most precious thing inside us and we surrender it to something else. In my case, that something was the wave.
Haruki Murakami's The Seventh Man, read for us by John Shea. We'll be back in a minute with another terrific story read by the master reader Marion Seldes. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by poets and writers on the web at pw.org, providing free resources for writers, including databases of writing contests, literary magazines, MFA programs, and more at pw.org. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our second tale of ever-deepening insight is The Rememberer by the Los Angeles-based writer Amy Bender, who teaches creative writing at the University of Southern California and has published three books, including the story collection The Girl in the Flammable Skirt and a novel, An Invisible Sign of My Own, which was an LA Times pick of the year. The heroine of this tale has a beloved boyfriend named Ben. But then, as she announces in the first line of the story, something quite remarkable starts to happen. The tale is told by the distinguished Broadway actress Marion Seldes.
My lover is experiencing reverse evolution. I tell no one. I don't know how it happened, only that one day he was my lover, and the next he was some kind of ape. It's been a month now, and now he's a sea turtle. I keep him on the counter in a glass baking pan filled with salt water. Ben, I say to his small, protruding head, can you understand me? And he stares with eyes like little droplets of tar, and I drip tears into the pan, a sea of me. He is shedding a million years a day. I'm no scientist, but this is roughly what I figured out. I went to the old biology teacher at the community college, and I asked him for an approximate timeline of our evolution. He was irritated at first. He wanted money. I told him I'd be happy to pay, and then he cheered up quite a bit. I can hardly read his timeline. He should have typed it. And it turns out to be wrong. According to him, the whole process should take about a year. But from the way things are going, I think we have less than a month left. At first, people called on the phone and asked me, where was Ben? Why wasn't he at work? Why did he miss his lunch date with those clients? His out-of-print special-ordered book on civilization had arrived at the bookstore. Would he please pick it up? I told them he was sick, a strange sickness, and to please stop calling. The stranger thing was, they did. They stopped calling. After a week, the phone was silent, and Ben, the baboon, sat in a corner by the window, wrapped up in drapery, chattering to himself. Last day I saw him human, he was sad about the world. That was not unusual. He was always sad about the world. It was a large reason why I loved him. We'd sit together and be sad and think about being sad and sometimes discuss sadness. On his last human day, he said, Annie, don't you see? We're all getting too smart. Our brains are just getting bigger and bigger, and the world dries up and dies when there's too much thought and not enough heart. He looked at me pointedly, blue eyes unwavering. Like us, Annie, we think far too much. I sat down. I remembered how the first time we had sex, I left the lights on, keeping my eyes wide open, and concentrated really hard on letting go. And then I noticed that his eyes were open too. And in the middle of everything, we sat down on the floor and had an hour-long conversation about poetry. It was all very peculiar. It was all very familiar. Another time, he woke me up in the middle of the night, lifted me off the pale blue sheets, led me outside to the stars and whispered, look, Annie, look, there's no space for anything but dreaming. I listened sleepily, wandered back to bed, and found myself wide awake, staring at the ceiling, unable to dream at all. But Ben fell asleep right away. I crept back outside. I tried to dream up to the stars, but I didn't know how to do that. I tried to find a star no one in all of history had ever wished on before, and I wondered what would happen if I did. On his last human day, he put his head in his hands and sighed, and I stood up and kissed the entire back of his neck. Covered that flesh, made wishes there, because I know no woman had ever been so thorough, had ever kissed his every inch of skin. I coated him. What did I wish for? I wished for good. That's all, just good. My wishes became generalized long ago in childhood. I learned quick the consequence of wishing specific. I took him in my arms and made love to him, my sad man. See, we're not thinking, I whispered in his ear while he kissed my neck. We're not thinking at all. And he pressed his head into my shoulder and held me tighter. And afterward we went outside again. There was no moon, and the night was dark. He said he hated talking and just wanted to look into my eyes and tell me things that way. I let him, and it made my skin lift, the things in his look. Then he told me he wanted to sleep outside for some reason. And in the morning, when I woke up in bed, I looked out to the patio, and there was an ape sprawled on the cement, great furry arms covering his head to block out the glare of the sun. Even before I saw his eyes, I knew it was him. And once we were face to face, he gave me his same sad look, and I hugged those enormous shoulders. I didn't even really care then, not at first. I didn't panic and call 911. I sat with him outside and smoothed the fur on the back of his hand. And when he reached for me, I said no, loudly. And he seemed to understand and pulled back. I have limits here. We sat on the lawn together and ripped up the grass. I didn't miss human Ben right away. I wanted to meet the ape, too, to take care of my lover like a son, a pet. I wanted to know him every possible way. But I didn't realize that he wasn't coming back. Now I come home from work and I look for his regular size shape, walking and worrying, and realize over and over that he's gone. I pace the halls. I chew whole packs of gum in mere minutes. I review my memories and make sure they're still intact, because if he's not here, then it is my job to remember. I think of the way he wrapped his arms around my back and held me so tight it made me nervous, and the way his breath felt in my ear. Right. When I go to the kitchen, I peer in the glass and I see he's some kind of salamander now. He's small. Ben, I whisper, do you remember me? Do you remember? His eyes roll up in his head, and I dribble honey into the water. He used to love honey. He licks at it, and then he swims to the other end of the pan. This is the limit of my limits. Here it is. You don't ever know for sure where it is, and then you bump up against it, and bam, you're there. Because I cannot bear to look down into the water and not be able to find him at all, to search the tiny clear waves with a microscope lens and to locate my lover, the one-celled wonder, bloated and bordered, brainless, benign, heading clear and small like an eye floater into nothingness. I put him in the passenger seat of the car and drive him to the beach. Walking down to the sand, I nod at people on towels, laying their bodies out to the sun and wishing. At the water's edge, I stoop down and place the whole pan on the tip of a baby wave. It floats well, a cooking boat, for someone to find washed up on shore and to make cookies in. A lucky catch for a poor soul with all the ingredients and no container. Ben, the salamander, swims out. I wave to the water with both arms, big enough for him to see if he looks back. I turn around and walk back to the car. Sometimes I think he'll be washed up on the shore, a naked man with a startled look who has been to history and back. I keep my eyes on the newspaper. I make sure my phone number is listed. I walk around the block at night in case he doesn't quite remember which house it is. I feed the birds outside, and sometimes, before I put my one self to bed, I place my hands around my skull to see if it's growing and wonder what of any use would fill it if it did.
Marion Seldes read Amy Bender's The Rememberer, and she took a moment to talk with our producer, Sarah Montague, about performing and about short stories.
Marion, how do you prepare for a short story reading?
Mostly I just read it and read it and read it and let it seduce me in a funny way, let those words and that writer's skill pull me into it. And then when I'm ready, I know I mustn't read it anymore. I mustn't make it commonplace. It's got to be a performance. I think if you get so used to the language of the author, then you can just sail with it. And whatever happens, that one performance, you only do it once, you know. It's as if you heard it for the first time, too. The people are there. And the excitement is there, and I hear Isaiah say, the next story will be read by and will be as was written by, and I think, here we go. It's like flying.
Let's talk a little about Amy Bender's astonishing story.
Well, I think it was an astonishing story, and yet, when I read it, it all seemed to make absolute sense to me. It's such an original idea. It's a spooky idea. It's an insane idea. And I think you believe every word of it. And every now and then, I'll read a story and think, I wonder how to do this. And the way to solve that problem is just to keep reading it. Not to want an instant reply to your own question, but to just keep at it, look for it. Search into it, you know, try to discover the astonishment.
What's been most important to you about your theatrical career?
I think the theater has formed my life. It has taught me more about other people than I'd ever known if I hadn't become an actress. More fascinated by the people in real life I meet because I've always been searching for the reasons why the characters I do behave as they do. It makes you more of a human being if you're in the theater.
The actress Marion Seldes. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.